It's not your fault, Waterford. You can't help it that you're rotten to the core. But it's time. You're just not worth a shit, and it shows.
Makes you proud to be a McCall, Dallas whispered.
Okay, John Harden, Sheriff Vandiver ordered through a bullhorn. Hit the switch and let the bridge swing back. You got traffic backed up for miles. They should never have allowed this bridge to be built, Sheriff. You know better than anyone. Remember how pretty these islands used to be before they built this bridge? You could walk for miles without ever seeing a house. Wild turkeys were all over the place. You couldn't throw out a baited line without catching a fish. But now, hell no. 1,000 generals live out here by their stupid golf courses. 1,000,000 retired colonels and their stupid wives built their tacky retirement homes. There are 7 golf courses between here and the beach. How many golf courses do these assholes need?
He's got a point, someone said in the crowd, beginning to swell on the bridge behind us.
Another crowd was forming on the ocean side of the bridge.
I gotta get my bridge back, kid, the sheriff said. This used to be a fabulous town, John Harden shouted, appealing to what he supposed to be the sheriff's shared sense of nostalgia.
Yeah, kid, it was heaven on earth, the sheriff said wearily, his voice oddly distorted by the volcano-shaped instrument.
Hit the switch and bring Daddy's bridge back to him, or I might have to hurt you, John Harden.
When he heard this, Dupree moved in to take over the negotiations by saying to the sheriff,
Hey, Vandiver, get this straight. You ain't hurting John Harden.
Won't be me, the sheriff said. Regulations say I gotta call the SWAT team from Charleston during a siege situation. They're on their way by helicopter.
What'll they do to John Harden? I asked.
They'll kill him, the sheriff said, especially since he's armed.
Call the SWAT team off, Sheriff, Dallas said. Tell them to turn back. We'll get John Harden to close the bridge.
It don't work that way, the sheriff said.
Then tell them his brothers are here and are going to talk him out of it, Dupree said.
Well, I'll tell him that, the sheriff said, walking back to his car.
John Harden was watching us carefully as this discussion went on, and he followed the sheriff with his eyes.
I know what you're saying, Dupree, he shouted. You're telling everyone I need my shot and then I'll settle down. The world may think I'm crazy, but I think the world's crazy, so who's to say who's right? I'm never letting another car cross this goddamn bridge. Fuck you, Waterford. Fuck you, little town. There's a reason small towns are small. You're small 'cause you're not worth a damn. A boat should never have to wait for a car. A car's an inferior mode of transportation. I've liberated the Waterford River for all the boats in the world.
Dupree stepped forward, the one who loved John Harden the best, and the one John Harden hated the most.
Close the bridge, John Harden, Dupree demanded.
Eat a big hairy one, Dupree,
John Harden answered, using his middle finger to give his words fuller effect.
This town is so shitty it gave my poor mother leukemia. When I was a kid, nobody died of cancer. Now everybody's got it. Explain that, would you, you stupid sons of bitches? None of you grinning idiots care about how you're screwing up this town. It started with this bridge. Too many assholes crossed this bridge with their golf clubs. They didn't know what matters. Beauty matters.
I'm going to lose every client in this town tomorrow morning, Dallas whispered to me. There won't be one left.
That's all, John Harden screamed. Just beauty. You people been to Hilton Head lately? They're going to sink that poor fucking island with concrete.
Close the damn bridge, John Harden, Dupree said, just loud enough for John Harden to hear him.
Commuters began beating their horns in frustration until the noise was too loud for anyone to hear anything else. John Harden fired a shot into the air, and then the sheriff and his deputies began ordering the protesting horns rendered silent.
That's my brother Dupree, John Harden screamed from his island of steel. If they had a contest to find the biggest asshole in the world, I guarantee he'd be a finalist.
Nevertheless, I shouted back, talking for Dupree, please close the bridge, John Harden. It's me, Jack, talking, and asking you to please close that bridge.
My brother Jack left Waterford and his family to go to a country that only eats lasagna and pizza pie and that kind of shit. So how does he expect to understand I'm not closing the bridge because beauty matters? It really matters.
Fuck beauty,
T screamed, exasperated and embarrassed by the ordeal.
Easy, T, Dallas said. We are face to face with pure madness.
Great diagnosis,
T whispered sarcastically. "When I was a kid, there wasn't one new house built on the Isle of Orion. Now there's not a vacant lot on the front beach. Erosion everywhere. Loggerhead turtles can hardly come up on land to lay their eggs. Just imagine what those poor mother turtles think," John Harden said.
"Turtles don't think. They're just turtles," Dupree said. "You're talking like a dope, John Harden."
"I never understood why you lived in Europe," Dallas said, "till this very moment."
"Lots of rentals," I said.
"What a loser," Dupree screamed back at John Harden. "You've been a loser and a phony since the day you were born. Mama just told me that. She's out of her coma."
"Mama's out of a coma?" John Harden said. "You're lying. Fuck you, Dupree McCall."
John Harden's voice was as poignant as a train whistle now.
"I won't close this bridge until everyone shouts, fuck you, Dupree McCall."
"Organize the cheer, brothers," Dupree said. "He means it. And if the SWAT team gets here, they'll kill our brother. They don't play."
We ran down a line of cars and enlisted volunteers from the crowd to pass the word from driver to driver. The sheriff shouted instructions to the large gathering on the other side of the bridge as the tension surrounding the siege began to mount and the very air felt dangerous to breathe. The sheriff took his bullhorn and said,
"On three! 1, 2, 3.
The town chanted, "Fuck you, Dupree McCall."
"Louder!" John Harden demanded.
"Louder!"
"Fuck you, Dupree McCall!" the crowd thundered.
"Now close the bridge," Dupree shouted, "before I come over there and whip your ass."
"You gonna pole vault, asshole?" John Harden shouted.
"There are ladies present on the bridge," Dallas said, changing tactics.
"Well, I apologize to all the ladies I might have offended," John Harden said, and there was true contrition in his voice. "But my mother has leukemia, and I'm really not myself today."
"Mama's out of the coma," Dupree shouted again. "She wants to talk to you. She won't see the rest of us until she talks to you. Close the bridge."
"I will under one condition," John Harden said.
"This'll be good," Dupree said to us, his lips as still as a ventriloquist's. "I've never seen him this bad."
"I want all of my brothers to get stark, buck naked, and jump into the river," screamed John Harden, and there was some laughter in the crowd.
"I'm an attorney in this town," Dallas said. "People don't take their problems to a man seen naked on a bridge."
"We gotta do it," Dupree said.
"Fuck you, Dupree McCall," T said. "I'm a public school teacher in this state. I can't do it. I just can't."
"If we don't, the SWAT team will shoot John Harden."
Dupree had started walking toward the opening of the bridge and was already removing his clothing. The rest of us followed him, also removing our own clothing.
"We get naked," Dupree said. "Then you throw the gun in the water. We jump in the water. You close the bridge. Deal?"
John Harden thought a moment, then said,
"Deal."
Dupree stepped out of his underwear, followed by T, then me, and finally a very reluctant and grumbling Dallas. John Harden grinned happily as he savored the sight of us, his naked and humiliated brothers.
"All of you've got little dicks."
Laughter erupted from those within earshot. Even the sheriff and his deputies laughed.
"Are there reporters here?" Dallas asked.
I turned around and saw a photographer with several cameras around his neck and another with a camcorder.
"Photographers, too," I reported.
"My career's dead," said Dallas, his despair deepening.
"This news'll go statewide in a flash," T said.
Dupree looked up and surveyed the sky, then shouted,
"Throw the gun in the water. That was part of the deal."
John Harden hesitated, then threw the pistol into the saltwater river.
"We're gonna jump in," Dallas said. "Then you close the bridge. Deal?"
"The drinking water in this dump of a town gave my mother leukemia. You get your water from the Savannah River, you dumb bastards. It's got nuclear waste, garbage from paper mills."
"Is it a deal?" Dupree repeated. "Mama's out of the coma. She asked about you first. She really wants to see you."
"Mama! Mama!" John Harden cried out.
"A deal?"
Dupree said once more. John Harden looked back at us. Suddenly, his eyes filled with malice, and he screamed,
"Jump, you naked bastards! Jump! And I hope the sharks eat your tiny little peckers right off. Jump, and then I'll close the bridge."
"I'm afraid of heights," T said.
"Then I'll help you," Dupree said, as he pushed him off the bridge. T screamed in pure terror all the way down until he hit the water. When he surfaced, the rest of us jumped off the Waterford Bridge together, and I think we did it with a fine sense of style. I hit the April cool water and went deeper underwater than I'd ever gone in my life, so deep that when I opened my eyes, I had to swim blindly upward toward the light. The water was opaque and cloudy with the rich nutrients that grew so abundantly in the jade-bright marsh. When I burst out of the surface of the water, my three brothers' eyes were fixed on the steel girders of the bridge above us, and as I looked up, the bridge began its ponderous, inanimate swing as John Harden kept his part of the bargain. The sheriff waved down to us and shouted out his thanks. The tide was incoming and powerful, and we were already 100 yards upstream when we saw the sheriff and his men put John Harden in handcuffs and place him in the police car. "What now?" T asked. "Let's let the tide take us to Dad's house," I said. "My career's finished," Dallas moaned. "Get into something new, bro," T said. "Like synchronized swimming, naked." We laughed, and T and Dupree immediately dove underwater, and their two hairy legs came out side by side with their toes pointed, and they kicked in unison a time or two before emerging, coughing and blowing water out of their nostrils, but still laughing. "We do have little dicks," T said. "Speak for yourself, son," Dallas said. "I can see your dick. We're all hung like chipmunks," T said, floating on his back, sadly examining his barely sufficient genitalia. "A question," I said, dog paddling and relieved that the siege was over. "How often does John Harden go off like that?" 2 or 3 times a year, Dupree said. "But this is new. He's never used a gun before, and he's never gone up on a bridge. I give him an A for creativity on this one." "It's sad, so pathetic," Dallas said, floating on his back. "Yeah, it is," Dupree admitted. "But it's also funny." "Tell me the funny part," said Dallas. "Our brother's being taken to an insane asylum in handcuffs." Dupree said, "You ever think you'd jump off a bridge stark naked with the whole town watching?" I roared with laughter and with love of my brothers as I began to backstroke through the water. For a few moments, we swam in silence, and I was lost in thoughts of both exhilaration and sadness. We were low country boys, strong swimmers, good fishermen, who had grown to manhood in a household of secret terrors that had marked each of us in different ways. We carried a strange darkness about us, composed of mistrust and distortion. We used laughter as both a weapon and a vaccine. As we moved, the water felt like cold silk on my body, and I had never known such a clean, animal nakedness. I listened to the small talk of my brothers and drew closer to them with every word they spoke. Through them, I could study some of the flaws I brought to bear in my own life. Like me, they had scratchy, muffled temperaments, but were courteous to everyone they met, almost to a fault. All were no-nonsense and rough around the edges, but they could look me in the eye, express affection with their laughter, and never appear eager to make it to the nearest door or the next assignment when I was in their company. We waved to people on the riverbank, and as the tide moved us, I could tell my brothers did not want this day to end any more than I did. Taking turns, we told stories to each other, and my brothers, like me, marked time by cherishing the details that stud the layers of each great story. They were Southern boys, and they knew how to make a story sizzle when it hit the fat. Their voices bloomed around me, and I loved the sound of my native tongue as it came out of Southern mouths. My brothers talked all at once, shouted each other down, as we floated through the heart of our river, the one that had sung to us as boys. Like evening smoke, I listened to my brothers' speech, their sugary accent with its soft, kittenish purr of consonants, its hissing, cotton-mouth sibilance. The tenderness of all words passed through the dewdrop illusions of my native tongue. In a small armada of brothers, I stroked through the waters that led to my father's house, aware that I would be on a plane headed for Europe and my daughter the next day, and that I had just lived through a week that would change the course of my entire life. I felt ties to this river, to this town, to this open, indwelling sky, to everything around me. My daughter knew none of this, or none of what made this so inexpressibly vital to me. Tomorrow I would return home, tell Leah everything I saw and heard and felt, then trust her open-hearted, hungering, and motherless spirit to forgive me. I had taken her away from what we both were. I had given her everything except the South. I had stolen her calling card. Mike Hess and Ladea drove me to the airport in Savannah the next day, and I signed on to do the movie project. Mike had caught me in a weak moment when I found myself fully in love with my own story all over again. Chapter 17. In the deranged but honored light that shone down on those years I call my childhood, I grew up in a three-storied, many-roomed house that made me fall in love with impractical architects who conjured alcoves and oddly shaped rooms large enough to spread out in during the most deadly quarrels of my parents. I was a nervous boy, and a secret staircase was my favorite room. Because of his love of the law and good bourbon, our father took the house for granted. But my mother breathed the house in through the pores of her skin, knew every inch of it by heart, and would even talk to the house on occasion when lost in her own thoughts during the labors of spring cleaning. To my father, the house was a place to hang his hat and his clothes and store his collection of books, but my mother treated it as a prayer answered by a generous world. It had been constructed in 1818 in what became known as the Waterford style. Its solid foundations were of stucco over tabby, and its two stories of verandas faced east to catch the cool breezes that lifted off the river, even during the hottest summer days. The rooms were spacious and high-ceilinged, and there was an attic that smelled of mothballs and cedar, and was crammed with enough discarded furniture and chests and piles of drapery to hide a small city of children in peril. But the house had come into the hands of Johnson Haygood and Lucy McCall out of controversy and by accident. From the beginning of their marriage, we were told that our parents acted like two storm fronts moving against each other. There was something mismatched and synthetic about their union. My source for this disturbing information was my voluble grandmother, Jenny Penn, who always let me believe that my mother had fallen off the back of a cabbage truck and had somehow lured my callow father to the altar. Perhaps reacting to this snobbery of his mother, my dad had brought my mother Lucy to Waterford as his lawfully wedded wife before he had mentioned her name to his parents. No one knew her, and not a single citizen of Waterford had ever heard a thing about her people. Nothing is more important to a Southerner than origins, and Lucy's were counterfeit the moment she met my father in an Atlanta burlesque club. My father had been drinking and did not know that Lucy was a stripper off duty. Johnson Haygood had just returned from fighting in the European theater during World War II and had seen enough carnage for a dozen lifetimes. He was looking for a fresh start, and Lucy was looking for a way out when they stumbled across each other. Their marriage took place in the office of a justice of the peace near Fort McClellan, my father in his dress uniform, Lucy in a loose, high-necked white dress. I was born 5 months after their wedding ceremony, and my mother used to refer to me as her love child, until Jenny Penn broke her of the habit. I liked being called a love child by my mom. I knew little of this when I was growing up, and learned it piecemeal, in fits and starts, during that time after my mother's first hospitalization for leukemia. The sources were varied and surprising, but the main one became my mother herself. Cancer enabled her to confront a past shockingly bereft of moments of grace. To Lucy, my father looked high-born and pretty. He appeared to be her best chance to escape a predestined and dreary life, and she took it without giving it much thought. Since she had no background at all, Lucy turned all her bright powers of imagination to the task and made one up. When she had to, she invented her own autobiography, and when it proved good enough for Johnson Haygood, she incorporated it, word for word, into the story she always told about herself. My father took Lucy O'Neill at her word and told his parents he had married a dancer from Atlanta who was perfecting her art as a member of the Corps de Ballet. In 1947, Atlanta did not have a ballet company functioning within the city limits, but our father would have had no way of knowing that particular cultural fact. Lucy O'Neill had an offbeat, nuanced kind of beauty that had sprung naturally out of a weedy gene pool heavily posted with warning signs. But it was her figure that drew men to her, those surprising curves that make words like voluptuous explode on the tongue with the sweetness of tropical fruit. I have always suspected that my father married the shape of a woman and had not a clue about the nature of that woman herself. He knew she was raw and unschooled, but had no idea she was illiterate. What captivated him was that he thought he saw in her a brightness of pure spirit. But in fact, he was marrying Lucy O'Neill to hurt his mother, and had succeeded beyond his wildest capacity for vengeance. Jenny Penn Sinclair McCall pronounced Lucy pure trash the moment she laid eyes on her. But a burlesque show is not a bad university for a 16-year-old girl who has never been to school to earn a degree in the behavior of men. In her world, a woman had to understand the alphabet and text of lust, and the lines were easily learned and put to use. Lucy always had an advantage over those combed and pampered women she would later meet in Waterford, because her knowledge of men came from the bottom and not from the top. She knew the boys, beer-sodden and screaming in the sawdust for her to take off her bustier and stick in dollar bills in her garters, and did not know the ones in their tuxedos talking about the poems of Sidney Lanier at fraternity parties during the spring. Her view of men was one-dimensional, but not inaccurate. Men were prisoners of their genitalia, and women were the keepers of the keys to paradise. Her theories about the relationship between men and women were brutally frank and animalistic, and she never changed them during her whole life. At parties, when she moved toward the lines of conversant men, every woman in the room fastened eyes upon her with malignancy and wonder. Though she lacked all polish and refinement, no one understood the basics any better than Lucy McCall. On the first day she met him, Lucy created for Johnson Haygood her past as an only child in a respected Atlanta family. She had grown up in a Tudor-style house on 17 Palisades Road in the Brookwood Hills section of Atlanta. Her father had been a member of the King and Spalding Law Firm, which was known as the only Catholic law firm in the city, and he specialized in trust funds. Her mother, Catherine, had been related to the Atlanta Spaldings on her mother's side, and both her parents were members of the Sacred Heart Church, and her mother had been the first Catholic member of the Atlanta Junior League. Both had been killed in a train wreck in nearby Austell when Garner O'Neill tried to race a train to a crossing. Lucy was sent to live with a maiden aunt in Albany, Georgia, whom she hated. She had run away from home when she was 16 and hitched a ride to Atlanta from a farmer delivering eggs to the farmer's market. From 1947 to 1986, this was the official version of Lucy's history, and not a word of it was altered for any reason. The story was a real one told to her by an old stripper who had been Garner O'Neill's mistress for years before a train accident took his life and his wife's. Whenever her husband or children asked Lucy questions about her parents, she wept so copiously and spontaneously that all lines of scrutiny or inquiry were cut off at the source. From this, my mother learned the power of both stories and tears. The tragic death of the O'Neills formed the outline of the story she claimed to have lived, but had not. She remained faithful to this story, which gave her more than a passing acquaintance with the soundness of the contrived and made up, the irresistibility of fiction. Jenny Penn McCall, who had grown up among the Charleston Sinclairs, and who knew in her bones the subtle secrets of breeding and refinement, spotted Lucy for the phony she was at first sight. By listening to her accent, Jenny Penn could tell that Lucy had not been raised in Atlanta, much less born into a distinguished family. Jenny Penn declared that first evening to her husband that Lucy was nothing but trash, pure white trash, and I don't believe a single word about her parents or any train wreck at the Austell Crossing. Lucy, knowing she had not fooled Jenny Penn, then set about to win the affection of her father-in-law, Silas Claiborne McCall. He was famous as a hunter and fisherman in the county, and Lucy soon learned that Jenny Penn had never fired a rifle in her life. Leaving her string of sons with Jenny Penn as the seasons passed, Lucy took to the woods with Silas when deer season began, and was there in the boat when the shad and the cobia made their runs upstream during the spring to lay their eggs in fresh water. During the winters, they sat together in duck blinds, waiting for the flocks of pintails, greenheads, and mallards to land in flooded rice fields. Because she knew the secret passwords that accrued around the selection of tackle and ammunition, Lucy found the gradual seduction of Silas McCall child's play. Though Jenny Penn complained from day one that Lucy did not know the difference between Grecian sterling and Roger's silver plate, Silas bragged that his daughter-in-law could cast a line as far as a man and could track a wild boar through a blackwater swamp. Jenny Penn's complaints about Lucy were similar to the ones she had once made about Silas. When Silas set about measuring the character of a stranger, Jenny Penn would check the china cabinet for theft. Silas pronounced to the town that he thought his daughter-in-law was a good old girl. That was the highest recommendation among a certain order of Southern men, and the thing that Jenny Penn would always hate most about my mother. In the fall of 1948, after marrying Lucy, Johnson Haygood McCall entered the freshman class of the law school at the University of South Carolina in Columbia through the good offices of the GI Bill. He commuted from Waterford, staying in a boarding house 3 days a week, then returning to his wife and hometown for the rest of the week. The war had raised the level of his ambition, and he found the study of law easy. He was well-structured, rational, and just, and he discovered he had a gift for argument and wordplay. Law school also gave him a chance to mingle with women who had put off their college educations to work in war-related industries. The company of intelligent women was a forgotten pleasure to him, and that first year it made him critical toward Lucy, whose commonness was highlighted by her vivacity and freshness. An early bitterness set in as Johnson Haygood regretted his impulsive marriage and recognized how little an asset Lucy was going to be. He discovered, quite by accident, that she had never heard of Mozart or Milton or the Holy Roman Empire. Not only was she unlettered, she seemed to possess almost no natural curiosity at all about his study of jurisprudence. Each day she listened to the radio, and he never saw her reading a book or a magazine, and she seemed utterly bored whenever he tried to discuss a thorny problem in contract law with her. When he told her he wanted her to enroll in some college courses to broaden herself, Lucy told him straight out that all her energies and attention would be devoted to the care of her children. If he wanted a college-educated woman, he should have thought of that before he married her. Lucy's happiness with her pregnancy was so touching to Johnson Haygood that he let himself be carried away with the childlike sense of mystery she brought to the task. His capitulation sealed a lifelong pattern between them. The child in Lucy seemed always to reign over the man in my father. "Watch out for vulnerable women," my father would later tell us. "Vulnerable will get you every time." The pregnancy forced Jenny Penn to action. She practically abducted Lucy to Charleston for a month and conducted a crash course in the customs and courtesies of Southern life. Admonishing Lucy to observe and not to speak, Jenny Penn imparted a basic knowledge of silver, china patterns, table manners, small talk, and codes of conduct during those 4 weeks of intensive training. In that short period, Jenny Penn learned to her dismay that Lucy came from even lower orders of the White South than she had intuited. At Henry's restaurant on Market Street, Lucy had studied the menu with care and concentration, and then had ordered the same thing Jenny Penn did, each and every meal. Jenny Penn thought this showed little imagination or spunk, but it did show a willingness to learn, and Lucy's gift for mimicry approached the heroic. To Jenny Penn's surprise, she found that Lucy was a quick study. When they returned to Waterford, Lucy could hold a fork properly and cut a piece of meat on a Wedgwood plate without drawing attention to herself. She could set a table for 10 and knew what to do with a salad fork as well as a fish knife, and understood the difference between a red wine glass and one for white wine. Jenny Penn also taught Lucy how to prepare 7 different meals for each day of the week, since Johnson Haygood had complained that Lucy couldn't boil crabgrass. Though not renowned for her own cooking, Jenny Penn had been well-schooled in the basics, and she had been taught to cook in the distinctive and serious Charleston way. She even imparted to Lucy, with great ceremony, her secret recipe for crab purloe, a low country dish pronounced with a Huguenot inflection as purloe. Cooking, she taught Lucy, was one sure way to discern refinement in a woman. To take cooking too seriously was a sign of discontent, but to have mastered 7 unassailable meals that impressed both the palate and the eye was the mark of a serious woman who knew how to get by with just enough. Soon after she returned to Waterford, Lucy McCall and her husband rented a charming but shabbily renovated slave quarters behind the house of Harriet Varnadeau Coatsworth. Johnson Haygood had to use every ounce of grace and eloquence he possessed to rate an interview with the reclusive Miss Coatsworth, who was one of a long line of oddballs, a species indigenous to the small town south. She was a rancorous woman with a strong cast toward paranoia, who had long been feared in town. Her house had not been painted since the 1920s, and to earn money she sold off pieces of her family's antique furniture, one at a time, to Herman Schindler, an antique dealer from Charleston. She agreed to rent to Johnson Haygood because she desperately needed the money and knew that he was related to the Sinclairs of Charleston. She made the deal through a half-opened back door and without looking at the face of the man she had rented to, nor asking the name of his bride. Left alone for much of the week, as her husband attended law school in Columbia, Lucy began a long, slow courtship of Harriet Varnadeau Coatsworth, and she used all the tricks she had learned in her in-service training in Charleston. She picked flowers, both wild and cultivated, and arranged them in simple glass vases, then left them on Harriet's back doorstep. Whenever Lucy shopped, she made sure that she bought extra tomatoes or cucumbers, or whatever was in season for her landlady. Whenever she made biscuits or baked bread, she made extra for Harriet. There was no guile to this and no motive, but Lucy was as lonely and cut off in Waterford as Harriet Coatsworth. While Harriet did not allow Lucy to see her in the first month of the McCall's residence in the slave quarters, Harriet accepted the gifts of flowers and food. She fastidiously penned thank you notes on 30-year-old stationery that Lucy cherished, but could not read. Johnson Haygood would read them aloud for her when he returned home for weekends, and Lucy would claim she loved the sound of his voice, reading words so delicately strung together. Soon, Lucy began to set tasks for Johnson to perform around Harriet's house. One weekend, she had him repair Harriet's dangerously undermined front steps. On another, he talked Harriet into letting him up on the roof, where he spent 2 days patching a leak. He was skilled with tools, and Harriet soon emerged from her solitude and began to depend on him as a handyman. But it was to Lucy that she lost her heart. Once, after seeing no sign of life or movement at Harriet's for several days running, Lucy pushed open the back door and entered the mildewed, decaying wreck of a house. Furniture was piled to the ceiling in some of the rooms, but Lucy followed a path through the furniture that led from room to room, until she came to a beautifully carved circular stairway. The house felt as if it were underwater, and the mildew had an iodine smell like a bed of kelp. A bit of flowered wallpaper came off in her hand as she began to climb the stairs, calling, "Miss Coatsworth! Miss Coatsworth!" When she finally got to the master bedroom, she pushed open the door and saw Harriet Coatsworth passed out on her bedroom floor, lying in a pool of her own urine. When Harriet awoke in her bedroom that night, Lucy was with her, and she told the older woman that she had double pneumonia, but that old Dr. Lawrence had given her a huge dose of penicillin and thought they had caught the disease in time. Lucy had cleaned up the bedroom and had placed fresh flowers everywhere. She had disinfected the bathroom and changed the linen and thrown open the curtains to sunlight for the first time in years. But Harriet was far too weak and disoriented to complain about anything. Though her blue eyes were suspicious and fearful, she was not conscious long enough to make a scene. When she awoke again, Lucy spoon-fed Harriet homemade vegetable soup. Lucy nursed Harriet through her bout with pneumonia and did it with grace and good cheer. In those 2 weeks, the Waterford-maligned Miss Coatsworth found the daughter she never bore, and in the last 2 years of Harriet's lifetime, Lucy learned how a daughter is supposed to act when a mother figure lies dying before her. Both brought sufficient wounds from their own pasts to make up for the extraordinary abyss that separated them socially. Harriet continued the process that Jenny Penn had begun in Charleston and began to teach Lucy some of the traps and perils she would encounter during her life in Waterford. The older woman told Lucy of the secrets and scandals that had disfigured the histories of the old families of Waterford. There was nothing like a scandal to demythologize the sheen and vigor of a grand old South Carolina name. She proved this by telling Lucy about the fall of a dozen distinguished families whose patriarchs and sons could not keep their hands off girls from the lower classes. Though Harriet was telling the same story that had befallen Johnson Haygood, she did not seem to make the connection, for her growing affection for Lucy had blinded her. On November 5, 1948, I was born in an upstairs bedroom of the Vonnadoe Coatsworth house, in the four-poster bed where generations of both Vonnadoes and Coatsworths had been born. I was christened Johnson Vonnadoe Coatsworth McCall, at Harriet's insistent urging, and Lucy was delighted to comply, since the name infuriated Jenny Penn. All Waterford laughed when Lucy bestowed this honorable, tongue-twisting name on her firstborn son, but Harriet Vonnadoe Coatsworth wept with happiness. It had been her intention to name a son after her beloved father, and she'd finally lived to see this wish consummated. The Vonnadoe Coatsworth in the central nervous system of my baptismal name caused me great discomfort during my childhood, because the whole town knew that I was no Coatsworth and had never laid eyes on a natural-born Vonnadoe. My passport and driver's license identified me always as John V.C. McCall, and during the Vietnam War, I claimed to campus activists at the university that my parents had named me for the Viet Cong. Throughout my life, it was only with a rare friend or deep in the middle of a drunken evening when I would reveal, with shame and apology, the pretentious Midlands of my given name. For 6 months, Waterford laughed at Lucy's grandiosity, until Harriet died suddenly in her sleep. The laughter stopped forever when Harriet's will was read, and everything she owned, including the Vonnadoe Coatsworth house, went to Johnson Haygood and Lucy McCall. Ownership transfigured Lucy. She loved the size and shape and simple grandeur of the house where she would raise her children. The house imparted to my mother a passion for beautiful architecture, an uncanny eye for antiques, the habits of a gardener, the compulsiveness of a bird watcher, and a love of the sound of rainwater tap dancing on an oxidized tin roof during a summer storm. Both she and my father restored the rundown overload of antiques they found in the rooms and halls and attics throughout the house. The house brought them together in a way nothing else had done, not even my birth. The Vonnadoe Coatsworth house was a valediction of my parents' queer union, but the story behind their unexpected inheritance transfigured my mother and made her feel that she might be in the middle of living out a lucky life despite everything. Lucy called it the greatest story ever to come out of the South, and told it to those reverential clusters of tourists who would traipse through our house each year in the spring tour. My mother would dress up in southern crinolines, her bare shoulders pretty in the candlelight, and give the visitors a brief history of her house before she blew their socks off and changed the spring tours forever by relating the story that Harriet Coatsworth had told her in the days leading up to my birth. Each year my brothers and I would gather to hear my mother describe the lovely Elizabeth Barnwell Coatsworth, Harriet's great aunt, who once walked the wide-board pine floors where we played as rough-and-tumble boys. She would tell her story with such passionate conviction that we, her worshipful sons, would think she was narrating the tale of her own maidenhood, when we thought she must have appeared as lovely and magical to young men as she did to us. "Her name was Elizabeth Barnwell Coatsworth," my mother would begin, "and she was born in the bedroom where my own son Jack was born well over 100 years later. Her beauty was legendary by the time her parents sent her to a finishing school in Charleston. While attending a dance south of Broad, Elizabeth first met a presentable young lieutenant stationed at Fort Moultrie by the name of William Tecumseh Sherman. One dance with her put this West Point graduate under her spell." Whenever Lucy mentioned the name of the Antichrist, Sherman, a gasp would go up from the assemblage, who were mostly Southern and had grown up with their relatives passing down stories of Sherman's rape and despoliation of the South. No Southerner, no matter how liberal of spirit, could ever forgive Sherman's prodigious march to the sea when he broke the back of the Confederacy forever. My mother played the crowd's abhorrence of Sherman for all it was worth.
We would stand above her, lined along the banisters in our pajamas, and my mother would wink at us, and we would wink back as her voice continued to weave the spell of Elizabeth and her suitor. Though the crowd never saw us, we kept in Lucy's line of sight, and her story thrilled us every time we heard her tell it. Each year we heard the story grow and change as she added details of her own. Because the story of Sherman and Elizabeth belonged to my mother and to her alone, it marked the beginning of her transfiguration in Waterford society. All through my childhood, she met those well-dressed crowds on the spring tour, who moved from street to street, led by guides who carried silver candelabras to light their paths. Since she had been on stage before, Lucy found that playing her part of a southern lady of breeding and leisure was easy. When she greeted the hushed, shuffling throngs who approached these old houses as though they were private chapels, Lucy could hear the indrawn breath of the entire group as she made her appearance on her own veranda, wearing a dress that Ginny Penn had given her. Through the years, as my mother gained confidence in herself and in her position in the town, she became famous in the neighborhood for her storytelling gift. My mother gave credit where credit was due, and claimed she owed it all to General Sherman. My poor brother T., who grew up mortified by his given name, Tecumseh, was christened in honor of the soldier, not the great chieftain. When I was a senior in high school, one of my Christmas gifts was my own ticket to the annual spring tour of homes. Many of the parents of my classmates went in together and got a special group rate, thinking it was high time that their graduating seniors learned about the architectural glories of our town. That night, in 1966, I approached the house I grew up in as a tourist for the first time, and I shared the crowd's wonder when my mother stepped out in her southern plantation dress, her hair done in ringlets, her face aglow in the soft, fallen light of candles. I looked upstairs and saw my younger brothers positioning themselves between the spaces of the dowels on the upstairs veranda. In the early years, my mother was callow and got many of her facts wrong, but she told the story of the house on this night with an air of solid professionalism. Her voice was lovely as she welcomed the group that gathered in a semicircle before the front steps. When she welcomed the 10 seniors from Waterford High, we let out a great cheer. I was holding hands with Ladera Ansley, and we were coming to the end of our high school romance. Jordan was dating Shyla, and Mike and Capers had brought the sassy McGee twins, whose parents sat on the board of the Historic Foundation. I'd always heard the Sherman story hidden away in shadows, catching snatches of it as my mother led the crowd from room to room. I cannot tell you how proud I was that night when I listened to my mother's voice begin to tell the story of Harriet Vonnadoe Coatsworth, which led to the story of Harriet's great-aunt Elizabeth. She had been born in a rare Waterford snowstorm, and some of Elizabeth's extraordinary charm was attributed to the 6 inches of snow that blanketed the town on the night of her birth. As I heard Lucy list all the delicious details of Elizabeth's life, proclaiming the former occupant's specialness and all-absorbing rarity, once again I fell under her spell. Making a motion for all of us to follow, my mother led the visitors into the living room, where she waited patiently for all to settle in before she continued. Shyla held on to Jordan's arm, saw me watching them, and blew me an exaggerated kiss that I pretended to catch in midair. Mike Hess carried a passion for history even then, and he hung on every word my mother spoke. Capers lifted up a serving dish from a secretary in the hallway, turned it over, and read the word spode to himself. Capers knew well my mother was an upstart and a pretender, and he hoped to catch her in an error of taste. But Lucy had a 17-year head start on him, and she long ago had perfected her game plan. What was inauthentic in our house, and there was much, was kept well out of sight during these azalea-rich days of the spring tour. In the early years, she had made such missteps, but social humiliation was a fast cure for either oversight or ignorance. She covered her traces well and never made the same mistake twice. After that first dance, Lieutenant Sherman wrote to Elizabeth in the raw, honest prose style he would use in his memoirs. He told her that his dance with her had changed his life forever. "Do I have the same effect on you, Jordan?" I heard Shyla whisper near me. "The same," Jordan whispered in her ear. "And you, Jack?" she said, winking at me.
"Elizabeth," I whispered to her. "Oh, Elizabeth."
And Shyla curtsied, and an older lady put a finger to her lips. Sherman told her that it was the first time in his life that he consciously wished for a band to play on forever, and for a waltz to never end, my mother said. But he had to join a veritable army of low country gentlemen who knew that Elizabeth was the one exceptional prize of that season. All the Charleston boys were mad for our Elizabeth. But it was Sherman who intrigued her, Sherman she wrote home about to her mother and father, who read these letters in this very room. She described the walks that she and her lieutenant took in the long afternoons. The walks were slow and intimate, and they told each other secrets about themselves they had never told anyone else. Capers raised his hand, and Lucy said, "Yes, Capers, do you have a question?"
"Was Sherman handsome?" he asked. "I always thought he was ugly as homemade sin."
The members of the group laughed demurely.
"Was Sherman as good-looking as Capers?" Mike said. "That's all Capers really cares about, Mrs. McCall."
Again there was good-natured laughing, and Lucy said, "He was not considered a handsome man by his contemporaries. But as many of the women in this room could tell you, looks are not always the main thing. There is the matter of character, ambition, and passion. People speak of his intensity. There was even rumor of a Charleston boy from a good family who wanted to challenge Sherman to a duel because of Elizabeth. But it was Sherman's look that made him think Sherman might be the wrong man to challenge." Sherman kissed Elizabeth at least once, and there is proof of this in a letter that Elizabeth wrote to her young niece, Harriet Coatsworth's mother. After that kiss, both felt themselves betrothed to each other forever. It was then that Sherman came to this house to meet Elizabeth's parents. It was in this room that Sherman asked to have a word with Elizabeth's father alone. He asked Mr. Coatsworth for his daughter's hand in marriage. When Elizabeth and her mother returned from a nervous walk in the garden, both women broke into tears when they smelled cigar smoke. "Let us go into the library, and I'll tell you what happened." My mother led the way, slim-waisted and girlish, and I felt myself about to burst with pride for her bravura performance. She had turned herself, through years of dedication and hard work, into a woman worthy to live in this house. A fierce autodidact, she had remade herself into something she had not been born to be. I felt like carrying a sign saying that it was my mother conducting this tour and telling this story. Already I could feel the group hooked by the unlikely romance of Sherman and Elizabeth. "What happened?" Mike Hess said, as the tour settled about the library with its leather-bound sets of books.
"Whatever it was, it sure wasn't good for the South," an elderly man said. "She's talking about the devil incarnate."
"The Sherman boy sounds kind of sweet to me," the man's wife said, teasing him. "On May 13th, 1846, Congress declared war on Mexico," my mother said, "and the following week Lieutenant Sherman received orders that his battalion would join the Army of the West before moving out to the territory of New Mexico to defend Santa Fe."
"What about Elizabeth?" Shyla asked.
"Did she get married, Mrs. McCall?" Jordan asked.
My mother played the crowd perfectly, then said, "William Tecumseh Sherman and Elizabeth Barnwell Coatsworth never laid eyes on each other again." There was an audible gasp, and Lucy waited a moment before resuming her narrative. But now she had them all in the palm of her hand, and I learned much about how to hold the attention of strangers by observing my mother closely that evening. Her voice began again, rising up above the breathless, ingathered group who strained to hear her every word. After a full year passed, they broke off their engagement with great regret on both sides, and 6 months later Elizabeth married Tanner Prelew Sams, a merchant from Charleston with an impeccable family line and possessor of all the effortless grace of the Southern manner that Sherman, with his chilly Midwestern reserve, had lacked. Tanner Sams had been the spurned suitor who had talked of challenging the young Sherman to a duel because of his courtship of Elizabeth. Patience and the outbreak of a strange war won the heart of Elizabeth for Tanner Sams, who remained grateful to the armies of Santa Ana until his dying days. So Elizabeth faded into her role of wife and mother and hostess and, by all accounts, brought a great dignity to every aspect of her life. Her character was true, and her beauty deepened with the years, and even Mary Chestnut cited her attendance at 3 balls in her Civil War diary, and each citation was more glittering than the last. After the Civil War began, Sherman did not come south again until he came to set it on fire. He made the South suffer and burn in the high octane of its own passionate codes. More than any other Northern general, Sherman loved the South because he understood both its pride and contradictions. But his knowledge did not keep him from moving through its mountains and river valleys with a cold and unstinting fury. He had come with his men from the Mississippi to the city limits of Atlanta, and he had watched his armies choking on their own blood and leaving the corpses of tens of thousands of Illinois and Ohio boys planted forever in southern earth his men had made holy by their sacrifices. Cutting his supply lines, Sherman laid waste to Atlanta and taught his soldiers the value of matches when you wanted an enemy whimpering and on his knees. Sherman remembered his elegiac time in Charleston and the extraordinary love the Southerners exhibited toward their fragrant land and comely houses. For 500 miles, he ravished that pretty South and burned every house his armies approached. From Chickamauga to the Atlantic, he rode out the seasons, moved his men with relentless and inexorable cunning, and wrote his name in fire and blood across the sacrificial body of Georgia. Sherman made the boys of the South shed their blood and their lives in 100 Southern streams and fields and roadsides. He made Southern women scream out for their dead and wounded, and he found out that the suffering of bereaved and hungry women could be as effective as a fresh regiment in bringing a war to its close. He cut through Georgia as if the state were made of butter, and he taught the state some unalterable lessons about the horror of warfare. Through the long, cool autumn of 1864, he rode with his army loose in the field, moving unappeasably through the smoke of burning plantations as the South's first conqueror. Sherman's name became the vilest two-syllable word in the South. Beautiful women with the manners of countesses spat in the dirt after pronouncing his name aloud. Sherman was leading his men toward Savannah and the trading lanes of the Atlantic and the history of military strategy. He was riding toward Elizabeth. My mother continued, "When General Sherman took Savannah after his pillage of Georgia, it was greatly feared that he would aim his armies at Charleston, the city and the populace that had begun the hostilities in the war between the states. Charleston had endured a bitter siege, and all were preparing to evacuate the city before the onslaught of Sherman's army. The citizens of Charleston had already decided to burn Charleston to the ground by their own hand, and not to allow the hordes of Sherman to put the holy city to the torch. Those who loved Charleston would burn it. The Yankees were not worthy of such distinction." Rumors abounded that Sherman had moved his armies across the Savannah River, and those rumors proved true. The entire South and the entire nation waited to hear that Sherman had turned the fury of his forces on the city that had begun the terrible conflict. But as he reached Pocataligo, Sherman turned his armies on a surprise advance and drove them toward Columbia, where he wreaked great havoc and burned that city to the ground. After Sherman made his surprise move and razed that city, he wrote a letter to Elizabeth's mother, who still lived in this house. When the Yankees had taken over Waterford early in the war, her mother had refused to flee and spent the entire war under Yankee domination. They accorded her great respect. "This is the letter that General Sherman wrote to Elizabeth's mother," she said. My mother walked the length of the library as the crowd parted to let her pass. She flicked on an electric light switch, lighting a Chinese vase lamp that illuminated a framed, handwritten letter hanging on the wall. "Since all of you can't get close enough, I'll read this aloud if you don't mind." But my mother did not have to read the letter on the wall. She had long ago committed it to memory, and there was not a sound in the house as we listened to my mother's voice. "Dear Mrs. Coatsworth, I remember my evening in your house with great pleasure and much sadness. I heard about the death of your husband at Chancellorsville, and the news caused me much grief. I noted that the cavalry charge he was leading at the time broke the Union line and inflicted heavy casualties on the Union forces. There was honor in his death,
and I hope that brings you solace. By now you have heard that I am leading my army against the Confederate forces defending Columbia. The South is broken, and the war will soon be over. I would like you to extend my greetings to your daughter Elizabeth, and to tell her that I still hold her in the highest regard. I have never been sure if the war against Mexico and the great victories won by the American forces there were worth the loss of Elizabeth. I have thought of her many times as my army has moved through the South and inexorably approached that part of the world that Elizabeth once made magic for me by her simply being alive. I would like you to pass a message to your daughter. Tell Elizabeth that I present her the city of Charleston as a gift. Very sincerely, William T. Sherman, General of the Army.
No tour group in history ever got more bang for their buck than those lucky house lovers who were led through the Varnadoe Coatsworth house by my mother. I knew that every time she told that story, she was trying to regain something for herself. My mother wanted someone to feel about her the way Sherman did about Elizabeth, and she knew that my father would never be that man. I used to stand on our dock looking back at that sun-struck house of my childhood and tell myself that I would one day love a woman the way Sherman did. I wanted to walk the whole world until I found a girl I could write letters to that her descendants would hang up on library walls. I would march to the sea with that girl's name on my lips, and I would write her name in the sands until the tides washed over it. The story marked me, but it changed my mother's life. She had made the story hers and hers alone. It struck a chord of abundance and resonance deep within her. It could not mask the limitless hurt she had suffered as a child, but it could give her a rich faith in the future, in all the negotiable currency of pure possibility. This great story made the truth bearable for my mother. Against all odds, Lucy was the keeper of Elizabeth's house, the owner of General Sherman's pure cry of human loss and love. As the crowd moved down the steps away from the house, my brothers called out to me, and I turned around to wave goodbye to them. I would be leaving the house forever in several months, and my sweet brothers would be left to their own devices. "Hey, good-looking," my mother called out. "You're not getting away without kissing your mother goodnight." I blushed but ran up the stairs, and my mother hugged me tightly to her. Mike and Capers and Jordan applauded loudly, and I blushed again. My mother rubbed the lipstick from my cheek, and we looked at each other suddenly, and all the swiftness and cruelty of time came over me in a rush and almost brought me to my knees. My mother saw it too and felt it. Her eyes fastened on me, and her hand touched my cheek.
"General Sherman! General Sherman!"
a girl's voice cried out.
"We are leaving now."
The voice was exaggerated and southern, and my mother laughed and said, "He's coming, Elizabeth." I ran toward the voice and the outstretched hand, and was surprised to see it was Shiloh.
Part 3, Chapter 18. As a travel writer, I know my airports, and I know every square foot of the Leonardo da Vinci Airport in Rome by heart. But on the day my mother touched down for her first visit to Italy the following December, the airport itself seemed transformed and magnified by the significance of my mother's arrival. We had nearly lost her in that first week when she had been in the coma, and her recovery had assumed magic proportions for all of us. It had brought me back into the family circle after a long intermezzo of sadness and lost time when I tried to heal a spirit badly damaged by Shiloh's death. I had reconnected with something of the highest consequence, and the repercussions of that visit rang in the deepest channels with an echoing richness that amazed me. Going back to see my stricken mother, it never occurred to me that I would encounter my lost self waiting for me at her bedside. As the passengers began to make their way out of the double doors, past the customs inspectors and the unsmiling soldiers armed to the teeth, I pointed out my mother to Leah and said, "Go give that woman a hug. That's your grandmother, Leah." Leah moved easily through the crowd, and I trailed behind her. As Lucy searched for us, Leah approached her and said,
"Ciao, Grandma. I'm Leah McCall, your granddaughter."
Lucy looked down at her dark-eyed, lovely grandchild and said, "Where have you been all my life, darling?" Then knelt down on the floor and folded Leah into her arms.
Then she rose and kissed me.
We collected her bags, and Lucy, holding Leah's hand, followed me out of the Rome airport and into a Roman taxicab. My mother's recovery was remarkable, and her face shone with a ruddy good health that seemed impossible after the no-holds-barred assault her body had just withstood. Her hair had grown back, though it was very short. Her step was light, and I saw more than one middle-aged Italian man give her the once-over with their languorous, appreciative glances. She had written me that she was walking 5 miles a day and had only missed a single month of checking the beach each summer morning for the signs of a nesting loggerhead turtle. Even in December, my mother had the best suntan in the airport. Lucy looked out at the throngs pressing forward to meet travelers and shook her head at the noise and congestion.
"Gives new meaning to the phrase Chinese fire drill," she said.
"I'm trying to raise Leah not to be a racist, Mom," I said good-naturedly.
"That's not racist. I've never seen a Chinese fire drill in my life," Lucy said, "until just now."
She took out her Italian money, which she had acquired in Savannah for the trip, and showed it to Leah. Holding a 1,000 lira note, she said,
"I don't know whether that's worth a nickel or $1 billion.
"Think of that as a $1 bill, Grandma," Leah said.
"What a smart little girl," Lucy said. "A girl with a head for figures doesn't need to worry about hers."
"You look great, Mama," I said. "Remission becomes you."
"I was bald as a pig for a couple of months," she said. "If you've got any extra money lying around, invest in wigs, son. You've got beautiful hair, Leah, just like your mother had."
"Thank you, Grandma," Leah responded.
"I've got more presents for you in my bags than I have clothes," Lucy said. "Everybody in Waterford sent you a present because they want you to know how badly we want you to come home."
"December 27th, Leah said. "We're going back to Waterford with you. You're going to love Christmas in Rome, Grandma."
"Do you remember how much I loved you as a baby, Leah?"
Lucy asked, hugging the child to her.
"I can't remember anything about South Carolina," Leah said. "I've tried, but I just can't."
"Next summer I'm going to have you work in my turtle program on the Isle of Orion. We're saving the great loggerhead turtle from extinction."
"Wow, and I can see all this?" Leah said happily.
"Well, see it," Lucy said. "I'm going to train you to be a turtle lady."
"Waterford must be so wonderful," Leah said. "Do you know, Grandma, you're the first person I've ever met who knew the great dog Chippy besides Daddy?"
"Chippy," Lucy said,
glancing sideways and oddly at her son.
"A great dog."
"Oh, I tell stories about Chippy to Leah," I explained.
"Well, what's to tell?" my mother said, puzzled. "Chippy was a mutt, a stray."
"No, Mama," I said, and she caught the slight disapproval in my voice. "Chippy was a magnificent beast, fearless, brilliant, and a great protector of the McCall family."
"He sure saved the McCall family a bunch of times, didn't he, Grandma?" Leah said.
Lucy finally got it.
"Oh, yes," she said. "I don't think any of us would be here today if it wasn't for Chippy, that great, great dog."
That night, when I was putting Leah to bed, she hugged me tightly and thanked me for allowing her grandmother's visit.
"I love your mother, Daddy," Leah said. "She is so sweet to me, and you're exactly like her."
"Please," I cautioned, "don't go overboard."
"It's true," Leah said. "And she said I'm the spitting image of Mama. What does that mean?"
"A spitting image?" I said. "It means you look exactly like your mother. And would you like me to tell you a story? How about the time that Shala and I fell in love at the beach? Or any of the others?"
"Was your mother a good storyteller, Daddy?"
"She was the best," I conceded. "No one could lie like my mother."
"Is a story always a lie?"
I thought carefully before I answered. "No, a story is never a lie," I said. "A story gives only pleasure. A lie gives mostly pain."
"Then I want Grandmother to tell me a story," Leah said. "That won't make you feel bad, will it, Daddy?"
"Let me go and get her," I said.
"Good night," Leah said, kissing me. "I only like great dog Chippy stories when I'm feeling sad. Tonight I feel happier than ever."
In the living room, I looked out at the Piazza Farnese and watched the Romans hurrying through the cold, shut-down streets. I could see both the pedestrians and my own anonymous image in the reflected, backlit window.
In the same pane of glass, I could have an unseen surveillance of unknown Romans or the luxury of self-study. The travel writer was looking inward, and I examined myself. I had just turned 37 years old, but the slouching figure I saw squinting back at me in light and glass, high above the piazza, had felt inanimate and peripheral to the main flow of action for too long now. The figures below me seemed charged with purpose as they made their way across the piazza and disappeared into one of the seven streets that led into the heart of Renaissance Rome. They strode with purpose, armed with resolution, whereas everything I did seemed insubstantial and forced. I longed for engagement, intrusion, and a little more Mardi Gras than Lent in my life. Perhaps because of my mother's arrival and her surprising vigor, I realized that I had satisfied myself with observer status in the human race for too long. Caution had wounded me. Fear had gotten too tight a hold on me. It had slowed my step, eclipsed my spontaneity, my willingness to take a corner on two wheels. I saw myself as I was, framed in that window, a man afraid of women, of love, of passions, and the staying power of friends. At this crossroads of my life, all ways looked appealing, and I knew that was exactly what was wrong with me. I heard my mother enter the room behind me. "It's cold as Alaska in here. Don't they believe in heat in this country?" "I'll turn it up. These old buildings are drafty," I said.
"Also, be a darling and get your sweet mama a Chivas Regal on the rocks," Lucy murmured. "They do have ice in this country, don't they?"
I fixed her a drink, made myself one, turned up the heat, and walked back toward the living room. Lucy was standing in front of the long glass windows that I had just left, watching the movement of people below.
"What are those folks doing?" she asked.
She turned to receive her drink and said,
"Thank you, darling. I feel perfectly dreadful, like a herd of bison just trampled me downwind."
"Oh, it's jet lag. You probably should get to bed."
"I've got dozens of letters to give to you," Lucy said, "and messages galore, but they can wait. Now, what's this rumor about you and Jordan Elliot?"
"Just a rumor," I said. "There's nothing to it."
"There's nothing more tacky than a son telling lies to his dying mother," Lucy said.
"You're not dying," I said. "Don't talk like that."
"I'm officially dying," Lucy said proudly. "I've got a letter from my doctor to prove it. Tell Jordan this is my last chance to see him."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I lied, feeling trapped by the woman who had both taught me to hate lies and to use them when necessary.
"He would adore seeing me," she said, for it was impossible for Lucy to believe that any man would deny himself the pleasure of her company.
"Is there anything you'd like to see especially during your time in Rome?" I asked, changing the subject.
"Lourdes," she said.
"Lourdes?" I asked.
"Yes, Lourdes," Lucy answered.
"Well, that's in France, Mama," I said. "This is Italy."
"Isn't that just up the road?" she asked.
I laughed and said, "No, it's not just up the road."
"Well, if my life is so unimportant to you, I guess we can just skip Lourdes," Lucy said, pouting.
"Mama," I said, "I've been to Lourdes. It's all bullshit, and it's 1,000 miles from here." My mother answered,
"It is not."
"Mama, I'm a travel writer. I know how far it is from fucking Rome to Lourdes."
"You don't have to resort to vulgarity," Lucy admonished.
"The miracle business is in a slump," I said.
"Well, I heard there were some churches in Rome where miracles have occurred," Lucy continued.
I snapped my fingers.
"Why didn't I think of that? Of course, Mama. You want miracles? This city's loaded with miracles. There's the church with a piece of the true cross, and the one with the crown of thorns, and we'll have a ball. We'll go to every miracle-working church in the city, and I haven't even mentioned St. Peter's."
"I must go to the Vatican," Lucy said. "I've gotten you an audience with the Pope," I said, "and we're all going to midnight mass at St. Peter's."
"An audience with the Pope?" Lucy exclaimed breathlessly. "What dress should I wear? Well, thank God I have my real hair back. I look kind of trampy in my wig."
"Well, get some sleep now, Mama," I said. "You'll need to get rested before you can start enjoying Rome."
"I'm enjoying it already," she said.
Then she paused.
"Is there any special lady friend you might want me to meet?"
"No," I said. There's no special lady friend I'd like you to meet.
That little girl deserves a mother, Lucy said. It may not be my place to say it, but Leah's simply starved for feminine affection. She's got those funny eyes that a motherless child always gets.
She does not, I said, irritated.
Oh, you can't see it, Lucy said, because you don't want to see it. You need to be out beating the bushes, flushing out that poor girl a mama.
She doesn't need a mother, I said, angry that I could not purge the defensiveness from my voice. Maria loves her as much as any mother could.
Maria doesn't speak English, Lucy said. How can Leah learn about maternal love from someone who can't even speak the language?
I'd be better off if you hadn't been able to speak English, I said.
Her laughter was a shiny thing, like pewter flung high in the air, and she laughed all the way down the long hall to her bedroom. We visited the churches, chapels, and basilicas of Rome, seeking the saint that would intercede for Lucy. And while we did, I taught her to appreciate the coffee of Rome, stopping often for a quick espresso or cappuccino. Each day we had lunch at Da Fortunato, and Freddy would wait on us with his impeccable manners and fractured English. Freddy doted on Lucy, and lunch became both a feast of antipasti and pastas, and a time for Lucy, at the age of 58, to practice the art of innocent seduction in a city that honored food and seduction far more than innocence. Altogether, we visited 21 tombs of exalted individuals lucky enough to have made it into the calendar of saints. Lucy kept a meticulous list of the tombs she had prayed before. She revealed that she was certain that a delegation of these saints would be there to greet her if her prayers went unanswered and she happened to die. I would roll my eyes, but my mother was unflappable and tireless as I escorted her through those dark, ornamental streets, whose buildings blushed with the harmonious rouges of time, some ochre, some tinted with cinnamon, some with a brushed, uncertain gold. In each church, as we were leaving, Lucy would take handfuls of holy water and scoop it up and douse her lymph nodes where the killer cells of her leukemia had clustered. Then she would walk gamely out of the church, dripping holy water off her winter coat for half a block. This baptismal ceremony seemed ludicrous to me, to say nothing of embarrassing.
"It comforts me," Lucy would say, sensing my displeasure. "Just put up with it."
"Why don't I just have a priest bless the water in the Trevi Fountain?" I asked. "And you can swim a couple of laps in it every day."
"You always fail when you try to be witty," she said.
"We're going to be the first people ever arrested for excessive use of holy water," I said.
"The church can afford it, son," Lucy said.
"Finally, we've reached an area of theological agreement," I said. Since I gave one of the great tours of the Forum, I thought I would trick my mother into some real sightseeing by taking her down into the ruins of that unburied city. But nothing I told her about the workings of the Roman Senate or the rise and fall of Caesars interested her in the slightest. She was single-minded in her unswayable desire to win sympathy and medical intercession from some minor saint, and had no curiosity about pre-Christian Rome at all. "These are just rocks," my mother said, as I explained why the Arch of Titus was erected. "If I wanted to see rocks, I'd take a ride up to the Smokies."
"This is one of the places Western civilization sprang out of," I intoned.
"Well, you sound like a brochure," she said, looking at the guidebook I had written.
"Your books are hard to follow."
"You don't have to look at the book, mother dear," I said. "You're with me."
She said, "You just go on and on, so just summarize, wrap it up."
"Oh," I said, barely containing myself. "That's the Forum, Mom. Now let me take you to other piles of rock. But before we go, let me show you the Temple of Saturn. Ask this god to cure your leukemia."
"What god?" my mother asked.
"Saturn," I said happily. "Top of the line Roman god. It can't hurt."
"I'll not have strange gods before me," she said proudly.
"Picky, picky," I said, turning toward the eight columns.
"Saturn, please cure my poor mama of cancer."
"Don't listen to him, Saturn," Lucy said. "The boy's cutting the fool."
"Just covering all the bets," I said, leading my mother up toward the Campidoglio.
The day before Christmas, I took Lucy to the Church of Santa Maria della Pace, so she could cleanse her soul of all sin before she received communion at midnight mass on Christmas. We ambled through the Piazza Navona, stopping at booth after booth, so Lucy could buy figurines of the Holy Family, gaudily decorated wise men, and placid-faced shepherds for her manger back in Waterford. The piazza shimmered with a seasonal carnality, and hustlers moved with the ease of lynxes among the tourists. An elegant woman in a fur argued with a shrill peasant from the Apennines over the price of a recumbent Christ-child. A street artist, without a smidgen of talent, chalked a portrait of a Japanese woman who complained that the artist had made her look Korean. Entering the church, I pointed out the graceful, expressive Sibyls painted by Raphael, but once again my mother was uninterested in art when there was work to be done on her soul. She looked around at the dark line of confessionals and said, "How do I confess when I don't know a word of Italian?" "Here's an Italian dictionary," I said, handing her a small book. "Very funny," Lucy said. "This is one dilemma for pilgrims that never occurred to me." "But it occurred to Mother Church," I said, pointing to a confessional at the rear of the church. "There's an English-speaking priest in there. And what are your sins? It's hard to commit a sin on chemotherapy." "I despaired a few times, son," Lucy said, not understanding that I was trying to joke with her. "Well, that's not a sin, Mama," I said. "That's modern life tapping you on the shoulder and saying hi." "I shouldn't be long," my mother said, as she entered the brown-curtained confessional, and I heard the priest's screen slide back with a click. I listened to the murmur of my mother's voice behind the velvet curtain and the lower register of the priest's voice in response. Kneeling, I tried to pray, but I could not feel much action in the regions where the soul most frequently moved about, looking for comfort. So often when I came to a church, I would find myself considering the floor plans of nothingness, instead of trying to strike up a conversation with God. As a child, I spoke easily with him, but I had a gentler gift for small talk then, and took myself less seriously. My mother suddenly stuck her head out of the curtain and stared at me.
"Are you playing a trick on me?"
"Took you a while," I said.
"For penance, this priest gave me 5 Our Fathers, 5 Hail Marys, and said I had to bake him 12 chocolate chip cookies."
"These modern priests," I said. "They're going too far."
"Jordan loved my cookies," she said, then turned back to the confessional.
"This is a church, madam," I heard Jordan say. "I find your behavior appalling." Both came out of the confessional at the same time, and I watched as my mother jumped into Jordan's arms and he held her, rocking her, with her feet dangling off the ground.
"This means, Jordan, that some prayers are truly answered," she said.
"For me, too," he said.
"Since the day you disappeared, I've prayed that you were alive and well," Lucy said.
"Your prayers helped. I felt them," Jordan said, putting her down on the marble floor. "Please, I just had lunch," I said.
"Ignore him," said Lucy.
"I always have," Jordan laughed.
"Are you a real priest?"
"That's what they tell me," he said. "I just made your soul shiny for God. You're all set for midnight mass at St. Peter's."
"Does Jack go to confession?"
"Never," Jordan said. "He's incorrigible."
"Make him," my mother said.
"Unfortunately, Jack has free will just like the rest of us," he said.
"You look wonderful, just like a priest."
"You're still one of the prettiest women on earth, Lucy," Jordan said.
"Your order needs to spend more money on optometrists," she said, "but thanks."
"See you at the Vatican," Jordan said. "Bye, Lucy. Bye, Jack."
That night the three of us took great care in dressing for a Christmas party before we went off to Mass at St. Peter's. I took my time putting on my tuxedo, and Leah came in to insert my cufflinks and admire me. Leah wore a long white dress with a scooped neckline that showed off both her fragility and comeliness. Taking a string of pearls from Shiloh's jewel box, I placed them around Leah's neck as we both stared in pleasure into the antique mirror.
"Daddy, I'd like to get my ears pierced," Leah said to me,
the girl in the mirror speaking in the same precise voice as the child below me.
"Aren't you too young for that?" I asked her.
3 girls in my class have their ears pierced," Leah said. "I'd like to wear Mama's earrings. They're so pretty."
"We'll see," I said, looking at Leah.
Her eyes were palace brown, like Rome.
"May I wear lipstick tonight?"
Leah asked.
"Yes, if you'd like."
"I would very much."
"Do you know how to put it on?"
I asked. I don't. Of course, Leah said. I practice whenever I spend the night at Natasha's house.
Leah unfastened an evening purse that had belonged to Shyla and took out a tube of lipstick. She pursed her lips and expertly applied the lipstick to her curving, pretty bottom lip. Then she matted her lips together and moved them back and forth until the top lip had reddened congruently with the lower one. This gesture of Leah's, this application of lipstick in all its simplicity and innocence, I realized, was one of the first of those unrecallable milestones passed by every child in her inexorable passage out of her parents' lives. Her body was a timepiece, and Leah, not I, was its contented owner. Lucy walked straight into this rite of passage and said loudly, "Oh, no, you don't, young lady." She marched over to the mirror and took the lipstick out of Leah's hand. "You're far too young for lipstick, Leah, and you can march right to your bedroom and take off those pearls, too. It's vulgar to put pearls on a little girl. Now run along and wash